The next case that we'll hear is United States v. Bunton, and this is 23-2007.
May it please the Court, J.K. Theodosia Johnson on behalf of, sorry, I'm going to panic there, but on behalf of Mr. Bunton. This case is governed by Eighth Amendment standards, and if the conditions here couldn't meet the preponderance standard, there's no way it can meet the highest standard of beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, counsel, before you really get going, I want to look at the verdict form, because as I read your brief, you're saying that the defendant in this case was found not guilty as
Correct.
To AS and as to SK, and that is not what the verdict form shows. The verdict form shows that under the defendant acting under color of law willfully deprived AS of his right to be free from deliberate indifference resulting in bodily injury. That's not a charge of guilt or innocence. That was just the answer to the question. The jury said no, he wasn't.
You have to look at the jury instructions as a whole and the indictment that went back. And I think the jury instructions as a whole, in the way the instruction, the verdict form ended up, it's clear that they acquitted on the other, on AS and...
Well,
and
it may have been clear to you, but it's sure not clear to me. I mean, and there's been no objection raised in problems with the jury verdict in this.
Well, the other thing is throughout the process below, everyone agreed that it was just to Mr. Kinney who got the conviction. In the sentencing...
I hate to argue, I see nothing anywhere that says that he was acquitted because he's not charged under the verdict form of those offenses.
Well, in the sentencing hearing, they had made an objection because he had been acquitted of those things and they didn't want that considered. And the judge himself said, repeated it by preponderance twice, that he found the guilty of this. And I think even if you disagree with how the verdict form reads, which...
I don't disagree with it. I'm telling you that's what the verdict form says.
Well, it says the first part is he guilty of depriving the rights? And it doesn't give the elements, right? But then if you look at the where it split out, it gives the elements. He was deliberately indifferent and it caused bodily harm. And also the evidence was so duplicative that if they believed Yarberry and about Salaman himself, there's no way they couldn't have found bodily injury given what bodily injury is defined as, which is anything, essentially.
I don't want to take up any more of your time on that issue. I just want to be clear in my own mind and that you had a chance to respond. So proceed. Thank you.
Well, despite my colleague's kindness, I have a follow-up because I had a somewhat similar question. As I understand it, there's two distinct issues. Was there a violation, not of the Eighth Amendment, but notwithstanding the instruction, but of the 14th Amendment for pretrial detainees? Was there intolerable conditions of confinement that were perpetrated by Mr. Bunton? And then there's a rather lenient maximum penalty. And then the penalty is aggravated if there is a separate finding that finds not only were there intolerable conditions of confinement, but deliberate indifference that caused bodily injury. On the latter issue, until the second sentence of the conclusion of your reply brief, I never saw an argument that there was not sufficient evidence to find deliberate indifference causing bodily injury. Your argument throughout the opening brief and until the conclusion in that one sentence of your reply brief was all that there was not enough evidence of intolerable conditions of confinement. So as a practical consequence, I think the question, at least for me, is, well, for Yarberry, Salam, all of the other pretrial detainees on this van, can you consider the urine bottles that they had to urinate, you know, in these bottles? Or Salam's, the bottom of his foot, having to walk on urine-covered floor of a van that caused trench foot. You know, those things, not bodily injury, but on the more general conditions, are we confined to look at only the fact that Kinney wasn't able to urinate? Or can we look at Salam's inability to urinate? Or that Salam and Yarberry had their hands tied behind their back and couldn't eat for 9 hours once they left Scirocco County? That's sort of the practical question that I have. And why can't I consider all of those other pretrial detainees on that issue?
You can on that issue, I agree.
Oh, okay.
But even so, they didn't establish that there was a substantial risk of serious harm to any of them. Even with the handcuffing behind the back, it has to be done with a non-penological purpose, and it was done with a penological purpose here. Mr. Button is not a trained corrections officer. PTS gave him barely any training before sending him off on a road trip to transport up to 12 fugitives and felons with an individual with no training.
Did he not know that most people, that they have to urinate within a 36-hour period?
Well, why the log does reflect that, the government admitted in its answer brief on page 9 on footnote 4, I believe, that the log isn't entirely accurate, that both Yarberry and Kenny testified to stops within there. And then Yarberry testified that the longest they had gone without a restroom break was 9 to 11 hours. But even so, it's not on Mr. Button. You can hear Officer Heron, when they stop in Socorro, bellow at the detainees, "I don't have to let you use my facilities." And that is the problem. Mr. Button had to find a secure facility in order to allow these inmates to use the washroom. And he couldn't just go willy-nilly. And if the was not given that opportunity, that's not on him. That's on the company for not better planning for secure facilities.
That's your argument at the trial level, which is almost the same argument here. And I know, counsel, you know that in the sufficiency of the evidence standard, that is about, there's no higher standard almost than that. And you're telling me on the basis of just what I've read in the briefs and look at the record, there's no evidence, I mean no evidence, that's the standard, that from the standpoint of there's just no evidence that's going to support the conviction of your client under the sufficiency of the evidence rule. And I'm having a hard time with that standard when I apply it to your case. I can't speak for my colleague. That's where I am.
Well, let's look at the Eighth Amendment cases that set the benchmark, right? Those are preponderance standards. If you can't meet a preponderance standard, there's no way you can meet beyond a reasonable doubt. And if you look like at Despain, it's 36 hours in a cell continuously that's flooded with 4 inches of water, with urine and feces, and later uneaten food.
But he could urinate.
Excuse me?
But he could urinate. In a cell. It was disgusting. It was covered with feces. These guys are on a van without a bathroom and a water bottle that they empty out and pee in the bottle while it's moving. And so there's urine all over the floor. A guy gets trench foot from it. So you're saying because there is feces, we had one unpublished opinion that there was feces all over a cell that you can still go to the bathroom.
No, actually, disgusting. Into Spain you couldn't. Well, I guess you could urinate. There were no working toilets, which were adding to the mess. It took me a really long time to figure out where you could find something that would show the hierarchy of human waste, as the government put it. But I finally found it with the CDC, under what conditions you close a pool. You close a pool if there's vomit, if there's blood, or if there's feces. They don't even mention urine. So, and urine itself has for ages been used as a folk medicine for wounds. It's gross. It's gross. I have no argument on that. But that's not the standard. The standard is a substantial risk of serious harm. And it can't be a speculative harm. You have to actually point to something that's going to happen. It doesn't have to happen, but you can't just say, oh, it's so gross, something's bound to happen.
What about the testimony for Salam that he actually got trench foot? Now, I understand for some reason the jury said that there was not deliberate indifference that caused bodily injury for Salam, but again, we're not talking about that verdict form, which you haven't challenged. We're talking about intolerable conditions of confinement, and so if there's a, can we not infer, viewing the evidence of the light most favorable to the prosecution, that for Salam, there was at least a serious risk of harm, that he has open wounds on his foot. He's walking around in urine-covered floor, that there is a serious risk of harm, i.e., that it could cause trench foot for Salam.
Well, then you have to look at the second part, right, which is that it's deliberate indifference and that Mr. Button has to be actually aware of the condition before he disregards it. And the evidence is pretty clear that no one knew of that condition of Mr. Salam's foot until they got to Kansas. And, I mean, Yarberry testified that there was a smell, but, I mean, everyone agreed the back of the van smelled and they couldn't pinpoint it to Yarberry's foot. And so...
What about in Sirocco County when you actually visibly see Button throwing, tasing Yarberry and then throwing Kenny against the chain link fence and he ends up with lacerations? Can we not say that in Sirocco County that we can see with our own eyes that there was at least a serious risk of harm for Kenny throwing him against the chain link fence or for tasing Yarberry?
First, it's Socorro. It's really bothered me. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
I grew up in New Mexico. It pains me. Okay. So Socorro County.
Sorry.
Both of those are much more excessive force than conditions of confinement. And really, they're different analysis, right? Like, what is excessive force and what's a condition of confinement are not the same. And again, I point back to the legitimate penological purpose, which is Kenny and Yarberry were aggravating these other prisoners. It's a volatile situation.
He was aggravating Button because he's yelling at the guy in whatever it was you said, Socorro County, that we're being tortured on the van. And so Button says, yeah, this guy's going to be a problem. He's ratting me out. And so then he tases Yarberry and throws him against the chain link fence. Words can't hurt. I mean, we all tell our kids, school kids, that. And his words are, this guy's torturing me. Please help me, God.
Well, also, Socorro County did not think it was serious enough, so they didn't put them back on the van and send them on their way.
Yeah, and they stopped taking any more vans.
That was not just... Everyone likes to say it's just for this one incident, but it was more of a buildup. But... Okay.
Sorry.
Well, let me, before you run out of time, do you want to address anything about the distinction between malice and willful? Because I noticed that that's one of the issues that you've raised, that prevented you from having a fair trial.
Yes. So malice in law is a term of art, and that's why you have to give it a jury instruction on it to the jury, because no one...
Well, willful is a term of art also, according to our case law.
Correct, and I think they did get a definition of willfully.
That's what the statute said, that he was charged under willful.
Yes, but malice is commonly understood just to be bad purpose, more than just bad, like actually, you know, what deliberately indifferent would be. It's malicious, right? And they would both the government and the judge use a legal definition as a term of art. If it wasn't a term of art, it wouldn't be understood that way. And I would like to reserve the last of my time.
Okay. We will stop your time. Judge Kelly, do you have any questions?
I have no questions.
Okay. We'll hear from the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jonathan Backer for the United States. This Court should affirm the jury's conviction of Defendant Anthony Bunton for his abuse of pretrial detainees in his custody during a multi-day prisoner transport. I'll briefly address the three issues that Bunton raises on appeal. First, the trial record contains overwhelming evidence that Bunton willfully violated the 14th Amendment by creating objectively serious conditions of confinement. Second, the district court acted well within its great latitude to limit the scope of closing argument by precluding the defense from using a potentially confusing term to describe the willfulness element. And finally, the district court's Allen instruction, to which the defense never objected, contained all the indicia of a proper, non-coercive charge to continue jury deliberations. But this court need not wade into the record to resolve this appeal. Among the various issues and sub-issues that Bunton raises, he has waived, in whole or in part, all of them except for the closing argument issue. So this court can affirm the jury's conviction on largely procedural grounds. I don't want to leave the court with the impression that the United States is running away from the merits of this case. So unless your honors have any questions about the forfeiture and waiver issues, I'll move straight to the merits of the objectively serious conditions that occurred on this.
Well, the forfeiture issue, the Rule 29 issue, you know, the prosecutor stands up after defense counsel makes a very limited Rule 29 argument and says, there is a prima facie case on all of the elements, goes through all of the elements, and then the district court says, yeah, I find that there's a prima facie case. And we do have cases that say that once a district court adjudicates an issue on the merits, whether or not it was sua sponte or not, that excuses the forfeiture.
That's true, Your Honor, but you know, I think if you look at this is the initial Rule 29 motion. Of course, the question that, you know, an initial Rule 29 motion is waived when the defense does a renewed Rule 29 motion. That's Bowie. This court's decision in Bowie holds that proposition. But even if you're looking at the initial Rule 29 motion, yes, the United States identified the conditions at issue that arose to a constitutional violation, but it didn't get into a full in-depth conversation of why, you know, the human waste, the restraints, the heat all collectively amounted to objectively serious conditions of confinement and tethering it to this court's case law on those issues, because it wasn't on notice that the defense was actually challenging the deprivation of a right element. And so the United States would have gone into far more detail about why and developed the record much more for this court's benefit if it was on notice about
that. So how do we write this waiver argument? Do we, this waiver rationale, do we say that, well, the government did address all of the merits, but it didn't do it very long? It was just an abbreviated recitation of the fact that all of the elements were satisfied. It seems like a very slippery standard for us to articulate.
If I would say that the proper analysis is what did the defense say? And again, I think you start with the renewed motion. That's and there's no question there. All with regard to count two that the defense said at the renewed Rule 29 motion was there was not, the willfulness wasn't satisfied. That's it. And so there's no question, and the United States, you know, responded commensurately to that.
And stands on our prior argument, right?
Yes, but so even if you look to the initial, the defense specifically identified willfulness, color of law, bodily injury as the issues that they were raising in the Rule 29 motion and said nothing about deprivation of a right. But again, I don't want to get bogged down in the forfeiture and waiver issues because I think this case is so clear that there's overwhelming evidence of objectively serious conditions of confinement. And
well,
you know,
you bet, counsel, you've made a couple of comments that really bother me in regards to what the government is obligated to do. As I heard you say, that you're only going to do the minimum that's necessary based upon what opposing counsel present. And I tell you, if that's your position, you're on a slippery slope as far as I'm concerned. It's your burden as the government in every instance in regards to these. I don't care how little they do. It's your responsibility.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, if I left you with that impression. No, the United States went out of its way to address all of the elements of this 242 conviction.
I just want to be clear that that's not what you were trying to tell me.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
So going to the merits, you know, in assessing whether there are objectively serious conditions of confinement, this court looks to the totality of the conditions on the van, not just one by one human waste restraints, heat. And here there's an incredibly powerful heuristic that shows how all of those conditions should be evaluated together. We have not one, but two detention centers that took unprecedented actions in response to what they observed when Bunton came to the facility. So starting with Shawnee County, where Bunton's trip culminated, Officer Edwards viewed all the detainees coming in and noticed all these, in his words, unusual things, that they were wet to the touch, that they had articles of clothing mission, that Abu Salam obviously had this very serious condition that smelled like rotting flesh, he said, and then therefore told his superior, Lieutenant Barnhill, about what was going on, called him in the middle of the night. Lieutenant Barnhill undertook his own investigation, then called his superior, Phelps, who issued for the first time in the jail's history an order saying that these detainees cannot be released back to the custody of Mr. Bunton because it was so appalling, the conditions that they witnessed. And similarly, in Socorro County, as Judge Bacharach noticed, that jail stopped having prisoner transports come to that facility altogether in response to the conditions that they observed. So if this court's looking for a heuristic to kind of step back from the particulars here and say, did it in the totality, were there objectively serious conditions? Well, that's clearly meant just based on what the actions of these two facilities and the testimony from Officer Edwards, Lieutenant Barnhill, and Nurse Johnson about just what they observed in the totality at the culmination of this trip. I want to take a moment to just talk about urine versus other bodily, and I know it's gross to talk about this, but I just say that Despain itself cites to Johnson versus Lewis from the Ninth Circuit, which was a case about exposure to urine only, and in fact the defense cited that case. So it is not true that urine cannot be the basis of a conditions of confinement claim focused on exposure to human waste. In any event, for all the reasons that Your Honors pointed out, there are aggravating circumstances here that made the exposure to urine in this instance particularly problematic. Clearly, there were objectively serious conditions of confinement here, and deliberate indifference, I really don't think is at issue here because Bunton didn't just act with deliberate indifference towards these conditions. I mean, he created them himself. He's the one that prevented people from having restroom breaks for up to 36 and a half hours. He's the one that, in response to people speaking out against the conditions of confinement on the van, restrained them behind their backs for long periods of time, put them in a segregation cage, denied them food, water, restroom breaks that other detainees received during those long periods of time. He's the one that blasted detainees with hot air while they were complaining about the heat on the van while driving through the Arizona desert and said, I've got something for you when he did that. So he wasn't just deliberately indifferent. He was consciously creating the conditions at issue. And similarly with willfulness, Bunton just says that he acted at all times in accordance with his training. Well, that's not true based on the testimony that I just mentioned. But in addition to that, willfulness can be inferred from the plain wrongfulness of all those conditions. It can be inferred from the fact that PTS policy required him to report any time that he restrained somebody behind their back, any time that he put them in the desegregation kit for disciplinary reasons, any time that he wasn't able to get them a restroom break beyond 6 hours. Mr. Esquian, the trip manager for this trip, testified that he received no such reports. And it can also be inferred from Mr. Bunton's intimidation of witnesses and doing them, giving them favors that they perceived to be to make them quiet. So there's multiple.
Does that argument run afoul of the acquittal on the separate charge against Bunton for intimidation of witnesses?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because this court has precedent going back to Young versus United States in 1948. It's not the purview of this court to reconcile inconsistencies in a jury's verdict. If there's evidence in the record that supports the verdict, then that's fair game for sufficiency of the evidence review. But again, we're not relying exclusively on the intimidation. As I mentioned, there are many other indicia of that the willfulness element is satisfied. So I'm happy to answer any other questions about that issue. or the closing argument or the Allen instruction. But if Your Honors have no further questions, we'll rest on the briefs.
Judge Kelly, do you?
No, I have nothing further.
Okay, thank you. How much time does the appellant have? Okay, you know, I apologize to appellant counsel. I took up so much of your time. I'm going to give you two full minutes. So I'm going to give you 57 extra seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. So one of the things I want to point out is that substantial risk of serious harm is an objective standard. For the blasting heat, we only have Mr. Yarberry and Mr. Kinney saying it's very hot and it's somewhere in the Arizona desert. Arizona has many temperate regions, and like in March, the temperature varies greatly. So that is a subjective component, and it was only for 20 minutes. I mean, case law is replete with even in dangerous ambient temperatures, if it's less than 30 minutes, it's perfectly, well, not perfectly fine from a humane standpoint, but from an Eighth Amendment standpoint. In going back, things like the clothing, that wasn't in Mr. Button's control. The inmates,
what?
The clothing was not in Mr. Button's control. They came on with what they came on with. They got showers when they could. Those things were not within his control. I mean, he did the best he could under the circumstances, but the circumstances themselves are hard. He has to be cognizant of his safety. He has to be cognizant of the safety of the other detainees. He has to be cognizant of the safety of the public. So he has to be sure that he's in control of that van. And while he says that, you know, they're just talking out loud outside Riverdale, they were yelling and shaking the van so hard it was rocking, and they had to turn around and go back to Riverdale. This is not, it's not a serious risk of substantial harm, because he had a penological reason for detaining Yarberry and Kinney as he did, and it just simply doesn't rise to the level, of a serious risk of substantial harm.
Thank you. Well presented by both sides. This matter will be submitted. And then